closed completely. When he was done, the drawers were in a different order. The right order. He was satisfied that someone had pulled the drawers out to search beneath and behind them, and had then put them back in the wrong order. He went into the walk-in closet. He found only a quarter of the available space used. On the floor were two pairs of shoes, a pair of black Reebok running shoes that were dirty with sand and gray dust, and a pair of laced work boots that looked as though they had been recently cleaned and oiled. There was more of the gray dust from the shoes in the carpet. He crouched down and pinched some between his fingers. It seemed like concrete dust. He took a small evidence bag from his pocket and put some of the granules into it. Then he put the bag away and stood up. There were five shirts on hangers, a single white button-down Oxford and four long-sleeved black pullovers, like the one Meadows had been wearing. On hangers next to the shirts were two pairs of well-faded jeans and two pairs of black pajamas or karate-style pants. The pockets on all four pairs of pants had been turned inside out. A plastic laundry basket on the floor contained dirty black pants, t-shirts, socks, and a pair of boxer shorts. Bosch walked out of the closet and left the bedroom. He stopped in the hallway bathroom and opened the medicine cabinet. There was a half-used tube of toothpaste, a bottle of aspirin, and a single, empty insulin syringe box. When he closed the cabinet, he looked at himself and saw weariness in his eyes. He smoothed his hair. Harry walked back to the living room and sat on the couch in front of the unfinished solitaire hand. Edgar came in. "Meadows rented the place last July 1st," he said. "The landlady's back. It was supposed to be a month-to-month lease, but he paid for 11 months up front. 4 bills a month, that's nearly $5,000 in cash he put down. Said she didn't ask him for references, she just took the money. He lived—"
"She said he paid for 11 months?"
Bosch interrupted. "Was it a deal? Pay for 11, get the 12 free?" "Now, I asked her about that, and she said, no, it was him. That's just the way he wanted to pay. Said he'd move out June 1st this year. That's, what, 10 days from now? She said he told her he moved out here on some kind of job. She thinks from Phoenix. Said he was some kind of shift supervisor for the tunnel dig on the subway project downtown. She got the impression that's all his job would take, 11 months, and then he'd go back to Phoenix." Edgar was looking in his notebook, reviewing his conversation with the landlady. "That's about it. She ID'd him off the Polaroid, too. She also knew him as Fields, Bill Fields. Said he kept odd hours, like he was on a night shift or something. Said she saw him last week coming home one morning getting dropped off from a beige or tan Jeep. No license number because she wasn't looking. But she said he was all dirty. That's how she knew he was coming home from work." They were silent for a few moments, both thinking. Bosch finally said, "J. Edgar, I have a deal for you."
"You got a deal for me. Okay, let me hear it."
"You go home now, or back to your open house, or whatever. I'll take this from here. I'll go pull the tape at the comm center, go back to the office and start the paper going. I'll see if Sakai made next of kin notification. I think, if I remember right, that Meadows was from Louisiana. Anyway, I got the autopsy scheduled for tomorrow at 8. I'll take that, too, on my way in. Now, your end is, tomorrow, you finish up last night's TV thing and take it over to the DA. Shouldn't be any problems with it."
"So, you're taking the end that's dipped in shit and letting me skate. The transvestite off's transvestite case is as cut and dried as they come. No pun intended."
"Yeah. There's one thing I'd also want. On your way in from the valley tomorrow, stop by the VA in Sepulveda and see if you can talk them into letting you see Meadows' file. Might have some names I could help. Like I said before, he was supposedly talking to a shrink in the outpatient care unit and in one of those circle jerks. Maybe one of those guys was spiking with him knows what's happened here. It's a long shot, I know. If they give you a hard time, give me a call and I'll work in a search warrant."
"Sounds like a deal. But I'm worried about you, Harry. I mean, you and I haven't been partners too long, and I know you probably want to work your way back downtown to robbery-homicide, but I don't see the percentage in busting your balls on this one. Yeah, this place has been turned over, but that isn't the question. The question is, why? And on the face of things, nothing really stirs me. It looks to me like somebody dumped Meadows down at the reservoir after he croaked and searched his place to find his stash. If he had one."
"Probably that's the way it was," Bosch said after a few moments. But a couple things still bother me. I want to puzzle with it a little more until I'm sure.
Well, like I said, no problem with me. You're giving me the clean end of the stick.
I think I'm going to look around a little more. You go ahead, and I'll see you tomorrow when I get back in from the cut.
Okay, partner.
And Jed?
Yeah?
It's got nothing to do with getting downtown again. Bosch sat alone, thinking and scanning the room for secrets. His eyes eventually came down on the cards spread out before him on the coffee table. Solitaire. He saw that all four aces were up. He picked up the deck of remaining cards and went through it, peeling off three cards at a time. In the course of going through, he came across the two and three of spades and the two of hearts. The game hadn't stalled. It had been interrupted and never finished. He became restless. He looked down into the green glass ashtray and saw that all the butts were non-filtered camels. Was that Meadows' brand or his killer's? He got up and walked around the room. The faint smell of urine hit him again. He walked back into the bedroom. He opened the drawers of the bureau and stared at the contents once more. Nothing turned in his mind. He went to the window and looked out at the back end of another apartment building across an alley. There was a man with a supermarket cart in the alley. He was poking through a dumpster with a stick. The cart was half full of aluminum cans. Bosch walked away and sat down on the bed and put his head back against the wall where the headboard should have been, and the white paint was a dingy gray. The wall felt cool against his back.
"Tell me something," he whispered to no one.
Something had interrupted the card game, and Meadows had died here, he believed. Then he was taken to the pipe. But why? Why not leave him? Bosch leaned his head back to the wall and looked straight across the room. It was at that moment that he noticed a nail in the wall. The nail was about 3 feet above the bureau and had been painted white along with the wall at some point a long time ago. That was why he hadn't noticed it before. He got up and went to look behind the bureau. In the 3-inch space between it and the wall, he saw the edge of a fallen picture frame. With his shoulder, he pushed the heavy bureau away from the wall and picked up the frame. He stepped backward and sat on the edge of the bed, studying it. The glass was cracked into an intricate spiderweb that had probably occurred when the frame fell. The damaged glass partially obscured an 8x10 black-and-white photograph. It was grainy and fading to a brownish yellow around the edges. The photo was more than 20 years old. Bosch knew this because between two cracks in the glass, he saw his own young face staring out and smiling. Bosch turned the frame over and carefully bent back the tin prongs that kept the cardboard backing in place. As he was sliding the yellowed photo out, the glass finally gave way and the pieces dropped to the floor in shatters. He moved his feet away from the glass, but didn't get up. He studied the photograph. There were no markings on front or back to tell where or when it had been taken, but he knew it must have been sometime in late 1969 or early 1970, because some of the men in the picture were dead after that. There were 7 of them in the photo, all tunnel rats, all shirtless and proudly displaying their T-shirt, tan lines, and tattoos, each man's dog tags taped together to keep them from jangling while they crawled through the tunnels. They had to have been in the Echo sector of Kuchi District, but Bosch could not tell or remember what village. The soldiers stood in a trench, positioned on both sides of a tunnel entrance no wider than the pipe in which Meadows would later be found dead. Bosch looked at himself and thought that his smile in the photograph was foolish. He was embarrassed by it now, in light of what was still to come after the moment was captured. Then he looked at Meadows in the photo and saw the thin smile and vacant stare. The others had always said Meadows would have a 1,000-yard stare in an 8x8 room. Bosch looked down at the glass between his feet and saw a pink piece of paper about the size of a baseball card. He picked it up by its edges and studied it. It was a pawn ticket from a shop downtown. The customer name on it was William Fields. It listed one item pawned, an antique bracelet, gold, with jade inlay. The ticket was dated 6 weeks earlier. Fields had gotten $800 for the bracelet. Bosch slipped it into an evidence envelope from his pocket and stood up. The trip downtown took an hour because of the traffic heading to Dodger Stadium. Bosch spent the time thinking about the apartment. It had been searched, But Edgar was right, it was a rush job. The pants pockets were the obvious tip. But the bureau drawers should have been put back in correctly, and the photo and the hidden pawn slip should not have been missed. What had been the hurry? He concluded it was because Meadows's body was in the apartment. It had to be moved. Bosch exited on Broadway and headed south past Times Square to the pawn shop located in the Bradbury building. Downtown L.A. was as quiet as Forest Lawn on most weekends, and he didn't expect to find the happy hawker open. He was curious and just wanted to drive by and take a look at the place before heading to the communications center. But when he drove past the storefront, he saw a man outside with an aerosol can painting the word OPEN in black on a sheet of plywood. The board stood in place of the shop's front window. Bosch could see shards of glass on the dirty sidewalk below the plywood. He pulled to the curb. The spray painter was inside by the time he got to the door. He stepped through the beam of an electric eye, which sounded a bell from somewhere above all the musical instruments hanging from the ceiling.
"I'm not open, not Sundays,"
a man called from the back. He was standing behind a chrome cash register that was atop a glass counter.
"That's not what the sign you just painted says."
"Yes, but that is for tomorrow. People see boards over your windows, they think you're out of business.
I'm not out of business, I'm open for business, except for weekends. I just have a board out there for a few days. I paint it open so people will know, you see? Starting tomorrow."
"You own this business?"
Bosch said as he pulled his ID case out and flipped open his badge.
"This'll only take a couple of minutes."
"Oh, police! Why didn't you say? I've been waiting all day for you, police."
Bosch looked around, confused, then put it together.
"You mean the window?"
"I'm not here about that."
"What do you mean? The patrol police said to wait for detective police. I waited. I've been here since 5 a.m. this morning."
Bosch looked around the shop. It was filled with the usual array of brass musical instruments, electronic junk, jewelry, and collectibles.
"Look, Mr.
Obina, Oscar Obina, pawn shops of Los Angeles and Culver City."
"Mr. Obina, detectives don't roll on vandalism reports on weekends. I mean, they might not even be doing that during the week anymore."
"What vandalism? This was a breakthrough. Grand robbery."
"You mean a break-in?"
"What was taken?" Obina gestured to two glass counter cases that flanked the cash register. The top plate in each case had been smashed into 1,000 pieces. Bosch walked up closer and could see small items of jewelry, cheap-looking earrings and rings nestled among the glass. But he also saw velvet-covered jewelry pedestals, mirrored plates, and wood ring pegs where pieces should have been, but weren't. He looked around and saw no other damage in the store.
"Mr. Obina, I can call the duty detective and see if anyone is going to come out today, and if so, when they will be here. But that is not what I've come for."
Bosch then pulled out the clear, plastic envelope with the pawn ticket in it. He held it up for Obina to see.
"Can I see this bracelet, please?"
The moment he said it, he felt a bad premonition come over him. The pawnbroker, a small, round man with olive skin and dark hair noodled over a bare cranium, looked at Bosch incredulously, his dark, bushy eyebrows knitted together.
"You're not going to take the report on my cases?"
"No, sir, I'm investigating a murder. Can you please show me the bracelet pawned on this ticket? Then I will call the detective bureau and find out if anyone is coming today on your break-in. Thank you for your cooperation."
"Ah, you people! I cooperate. I send my lists each week, even take pictures for your pawnmen. Then all I ask is for one detective to investigate a robbery, and I get a man who says his job is murder. I've been waiting now since 5 a.m. in the morning."
"Give me your phone. I'll get somebody over."
Obina took the receiver off a wall phone behind one of the damaged counters and handed it across. Bosch gave him the number to dial. While Bosch talked to the duty detective at Parker Center, the shopkeeper looked up the pawn ticket in a logbook. The duty detective, a woman Bosch knew had not been involved in a field investigation during her entire career with the robbery-homicide division, asked Bosch how he had been, then told him that she had referred the pawn shop break-in to the local station, even though she knew there would be no detectives there today. The local station was Central Division. Bosch walked around the counter and dialed the detective bureau there anyway. There was no answer. While the phone rang on, unanswered, Bosch began a one-sided conversation.
"Yeah, this is Harry Bosch, Hollywood Detectives. I'm just trying to check on the status of the break-in over at the Happy Hawker on Broadway."
"Hmm?
He is? You know when?"
Uh-huh. You're right. Obina. O-B-I-N-N-A?
He looked over, and Obina nodded at the correct spelling.
Yeah, he's here waiting. Right. Yeah, I'll tell him. Thank you.
He hung up the phone. Obina looked at him, his bushy eyebrows arched.
It's been a busy day, Mr. Obina, Bosch said. The detectives are out, but they'll get here. Shouldn't be too much longer. I gave the watch officer your name and told him to get him over here as soon as possible. Now, can I see the bracelet?
No.
Bosch dug a cigarette out of a package he pulled from his coat pocket. He knew what was coming before Obina spread his arm across one of the damaged display cases.
Your bracelet?
It is gone, the pawnbroker said. I looked it up here in my record. I see that I had it here in the case because it was a fine piece, very valuable to me. Now, it is gone. We are both victims of the robber, yes?
Obina smiled, apparently happy to share his woe.
Bosch looked into the glitter of sharp glass in the bottom of the case. He nodded and said,
Yes.
You are a day late, detective.
A shame.
Did you say only these two cases were robbed?
Yes, a smash and grab. Quick, quick.
What time?
Police called me at 4:30 a.m. in the morning. That is the time of the alarm. I came at once. The alarm. When the window was smashed, the alarm went off. The officers found no one. They stayed until I came. Then I begin to wait for detectives that do not come. I cannot clean up my cases until they get here to investigate this crime.
Bosch was thinking of a time scheme. The body dumped sometime before the anonymous 911 call at 4 a.m. The pawn shop broken into about the same time. A bracelet pawned by the dead man taken. There are no coincidences, he told himself.
You said something about pictures. Lists and pictures for the pawn detail?
Yes, LAPD, that is true. I turn over lists of everything I take in to the pawn detectives. It is law. I cooperate fully.
Obina nodded his head and frowned mournfully into the broken display case.
What about the pictures? Bosch said.
Yes, pictures. These pawn detectives, they asked me to take pictures of my best acquisitions, help them better identify for stolen merchandise. It's not the law, but I say, sure, I cooperate fully. I bought a Polaroid kind of camera. I keep pictures if they want to come and look.
They never do. It's bullshit. You have a picture of this bracelet?
Obina's eyebrows arched again as he considered the idea for the first time.
I think,
he said, and then he disappeared through a black curtain in the doorway behind the counter. He came out a few moments later with a shoebox full of Polaroid photos with yellow carbon slips paperclipped to them. He rustled through the photos, occasionally pulling one out, raising his eyebrows, and then sliding it back into place. Finally, he found what he wanted.
Here, there it is.
Bosch took the photo and studied it.
Antique gold with carved jade. Very nice, Obina said.
I remember it. Top line. No wonder the shit heel that broke through my window took it. Made in the 1930s, Mexico. I gave the man $800. I have not often paid such a price for a piece of jewelry. I remember, very big man. He came here with the ring for the Super Bowl, 1983. Very nice. I gave him $1,000. He did not come back for it.
He held out his left hand to display the oversized gold ring, which seemed even larger on his small finger.
The guy who pawned the bracelet, you remember him as well?
Bosch asked. Obina looked puzzled. Bosch decided that watching his eyebrows was like watching two caterpillars charging each other. He took one of the Polaroids of Meadows out of his pocket and handed it to the pawnbroker. He studied it closely.
The man is dead,
Obina said after a moment. The caterpillars seemed to quiver with fear.
The man looks dead.
I don't need your help for that, Bosch said. I want to know if he pawned the bracelet.
Obina handed the photo back. He said,
I think yes.
He ever come in here and pawn anything else before or after the bracelet?
No, I think I'd remember him. I'll say no.
I need to take this, Bosch said, holding up the Polaroid of the bracelet. If you need it back, give me a call.
He put one of his business cards on the cash register. The card was one of the cheap kind, with his name and phone number handwritten on a line. As he walked to the front door, crossing under a row of banjos, Bosch looked at his watch. He turned to Obina, who was looking through the box of Polaroids again. Mr. Obina, the watch officer, he said to tell you that if the detectives didn't get here in a half hour, you should go home, and they'll be by in the morning. Obina looked at him without saying a word. The caterpillars charged and collided. Bosch looked up and saw himself in the polished brass elbow of a saxophone that hung overhead, a tenor. Then he turned and walked out the door, heading to the comm center to pick up the tape. The watch sergeant in the comm center beneath City Hall let Bosch record the 911 call off one of the big reel-to-reels that never stop rolling and recording the cries of the city. The voice of the emergency operator was female and black. The caller was male and white. The caller sounded like a boy.
911 emergency, what are you reporting? Can I help you? What are you reporting?
Yeah, I'm reporting you have a dead guy in a pipe.
You said you are reporting a dead body?
Yeah, that's right.
What do you mean by a pipe, sir?
He's in a pipe up by the dam.
What dam is that?
You know where they got the water reservoir and everything. The Hollywood sign.
Is that the Mulholland Dam, sir, above Hollywood?
Yeah, that's it. You got it, Mulholland. I couldn't remember the name.
Where is the body?
They have a big old pipe up there. You know, the one that people sleep in? The dead guy's in the pipe. He's there.
Do you know this person?
No, man, no way.
Is he sleeping?
Shit, no. He's dead.
How are you sure?
I'm sure. I'm just telling you. If you don't want to...
What is your name, sir?
What is this? What do you need my name for? I just saw it. I didn't do it.
How am I to know this is a legitimate call?
Check the pipe, you'll know. I don't know what else to tell you. What's my name got to do with anything?
For our records, sir. Can you give me your name?
No.
Sir, will you stay there until an officer arrives?
No, I'm already gone. I'm not there, man. I'm down.
I know, sir. I have a readout here that says you are at a payphone on Gower near Hollywood Boulevard. Will you wait for the officer?
How? Never mind. I gotta go now. You check it out. The body's there. A dead guy.
Sir, we would like to talk.
The line was disconnected. Bosch put the cassette tape in his pocket and headed out of the comm center the way he had come in. It had been 10 months since Harry Bosch had been on the third floor at Parker Center. He had worked in RHD, the Robbery Homicide Division, for almost 10 years, but never came back after his suspension and transfer from the Homicide Special Squad to Hollywood Detectives. On the day he got the word, his desk was cleared by two goons from Internal Affairs named Lewis and Clark. They dumped his stuff on the homicide table at Hollywood Station, then left a message on his phone tape at home saying that's where he would find it. Now, 10 months later, he was back on the hallowed floor of the department's elite detective squad, and he was glad it was Sunday. There would be no faces he knew, no reason to look away. Room 321 was empty except for the weekend duty detective, whom Bosch didn't know. Harry pointed to the back of the room and said, "Bosch, Hollywood detectives, I have to use the box." The duty man, a young guy with a haircut he had kept when he split the Marine Corps, had a gun catalog open on his desk. He looked back at the computers along the back wall as if to make sure they were still there, and then back at Bosch. "Supposed to use the one in your own division," he said. Bosch walked by him. "I don't have the time to go out to Hollywood. I got an autopsy in 20 minutes, he lied. "You know, I've heard of you, Bosch. Yeah, the TV show and all of that. You used to be on this floor."
"Used to."
The last line hung in the air like smog, and Bosch tried to ignore it. As he went back to the computer terminals, he couldn't help but let his eyes wander over his old desk. He wondered who used it now. It was cluttered, and he noticed the cards on the Rolodex were crisp and unworn at the edges. New. Harry turned around and looked at the duty man who was still watching him. "Is your desk when you aren't pulling Sundays?" The kid smiled and nodded his head. "You deserve it, kid. You're just right for the part. That hair, that stupid grin. You're gonna go far."
"Just 'cause you got busted out of here for being a one-man army, you... Ah, fuck you, Bosch, you has-been."
Bosch pulled a chair on casters away from a desk and pushed it in front of the IBM PC sitting on a table against the rear wall. He hit the switch, and in a few moments the amber-colored letters appeared on the screen. Homicide Information Tracking Management Automated Network. For a moment, Bosch smiled at the department's unceasing need for acronyms. It seemed to him that every unit, task force, and computer file had been christened with a name that gave its acronym the sound of eliteness. To the public, acronyms meant action, large numbers of manpower applied to vital problems. There was Hitman, Cobra, Crash, Bad Cats, Dare, 100 others. Somewhere in Parker's center, there was someone who spent all day making up catchy acronyms, he believed. Computers had acronyms, even ideas had acronyms. If your special unit didn't have an acronym, then you weren't shit in this department. Once he was in the Hitman system, a template of case questions appeared on the screen and he filled in the blanks. He then typed in three search keys, Mulholland Dam, Overdose, and Staged Overdose. He then pushed the execute key. Half a minute later, the computer told him that a search of 8,000 homicide cases, about 10 years' worth, stored on the computer's hard disk had come up with only 6 hits. Bosch called them up one by one. The first three were unsolved slayings of young women who were found dead on the dam in the early 1980s. Each was strangled. Bosch glanced quickly at the information and went on. The fourth case was a body found floating in the reservoir 5 years earlier. Cause of death was not drowning, but otherwise unknown. The last two were drug overdoses, the first of which occurred during a picnic at the park above the reservoir. It looked pretty straightforward to Bosch, and he went on. The last hit was a DB found in the pipe 14 months earlier. Cause of death was later determined to be heart stoppage due to an overdose of tar heroin. Decedent known to frequent area of the dam and sleep in pipe, the computer readout said. No further follow-up. It was the death that Crowley, the Hollywood watch sergeant, had mentioned when he woke Bosch up that morning. Bosch pushed a key and printed out the information on the last death, though he didn't think it figured into his case. He signed off and shut down the computer, then he sat there a moment, thinking. Without getting out of the chair, he rolled over to another PC. He turned it on and fed his password in. He took the Polaroid out of his pocket, looked at the bracelet, and typed in its description for a stolen property record search. This in itself was an art. He had to describe the bracelet the way he believed other cops would, cops who might be typing in descriptions of a whole inventory of jewelry taken in a robbery or burglary. He described the bracelet simply as antique gold bracelet with carved jade dolphin design. He pressed the search key, and in 30 seconds the computer screen said, no hit. He tried it again, typing gold and jade bracelet, and then punching the search key. This time there were 436 hits, too many. He needed to thin the herd. He typed, gold bracelet with jade fish, and pressed search. 6 hits. That was more like it. The computer said a gold bracelet with carved jade fish had turned up on 4 crime reports and 2 departmental bulletins that had been entered into the computer system since its development in 1983. Bosch knew that because of the immense duplication of records in any police department, all 6 entries could be and probably were from the same case or report of a missing or stolen bracelet. He called the abbreviated crime reports up on the computer screen and found that his suspicion was correct. The reports were generated by a single burglary in September at 6th and Hill, downtown. The victim was a woman named Harriet Beecham, age 71, of Silver Lake. Bosch tried to place the location in his mind, but could not think of what building or business was there. There was no summary of the crime on the computer. He would have to go to records and pull a hard copy. But there was a limited description of the gold and jade bracelet and several other pieces of jewelry taken from Beecham. The bracelet Beecham reported lost could or could not have been the one that Meadows had pawned. The description was too vague. There were several supplementary report numbers given on the computer report, and Bosch wrote them all down in his notebook. It seemed to him as he did this that Harriet Beecham's loss had generated an unusual amount of paper. He next called up the information on the 2 bulletins. Both had come from the FBI, the first issued 2 weeks after Beecham had been burglarized. It was then reissued 3 months later when Beecham's jewelry had still not turned up. Bosch wrote down the bulletin number and turned off the computer. He went across the room to the robbery, commercial, burglary section. On a steel shelf that ran along the back wall were dozens of black binders that held the bulletins and bolos from past years. Bosch took down the one marked September and began looking through it. He quickly realized that the bulletins were not in chronological order and weren't all issued in September. In fact, there was no order. He might have to look through all 10 months since Beecham's burglary to find the bulletin he needed. He pulled an armful of the binders off the shelf and sat down at the burglary table. A few moments later, he felt the presence of someone across the table from him. "What do you want?" he said without looking up.
"What do I want?"
the duty detective said.
"I want to know what the fuck you are doing, Bosch. This isn't your place anymore. You can't just come in here like you're running the crew. Put that shit back on the shelf, and if you want to look through it, come back down here tomorrow and ask, goddammit. And don't give me any bullshit about an autopsy. You've already been here a half hour."
Bosch looked up at him. He put his age at 28, maybe 29, even younger than Bosch had been when he made it to robbery-homicide. Either standards had dropped, or RHD wasn't what it was. Bosch knew it was actually both. He looked back down at the bulletin binder.
"I'm talking to you, asshole!"
the detective boomed. Bosch reached his foot up under the table and kicked the chair that was across from him. The chair shot out from the table and its backrest hit the detective in the crotch. He doubled over and made an oomph sound, grabbing the chair for support. Bosch knew he had his reputation going for him now. Harry Bosch, a loner, a fighter, a killer. "Come on, kid," he was saying. "Do something." But the young detective just stared at Bosch, his anger and humiliation in check. He was a cop who could pull the gun, but maybe not the trigger. And once Bosch knew that, he knew the kid would walk away. The young cop shook his head, waved his hands like he was saying, "Enough of this," and walked back to the duty desk.
"Go ahead, write me up, kid," Bosch said to his back.
"Fuck you,"
the kid feebly returned. Bosch knew he had nothing to worry about. IAD wouldn't even look at an officer-on-officer beef without a corroborating witness or tape recording. One cop's word against another's was something they wouldn't touch in this department. Deep down, they knew a cop's word by itself was worthless. That was why internal affairs cops always worked in pairs. An hour and 7 cigarettes later, Bosch found it. A photocopy of another Polaroid of the gold and jade bracelet was part of a 50-page packet of descriptions and photos of property lost in a burglary at Westland National Bank at 6th and Hill. Now Bosch was able to place the address in his mind, and he remembered the dark, smoked glass of the building. He had never been inside the bank. A bank heist with jewelry taken, he thought. It didn't make much sense. He studied the list. Almost every item was a piece of jewelry, and there was too much there for a walk-in robbery. Harriet Beecham alone was listed as having lost 8 antique rings, 4 bracelets, 4 earrings. Besides that, these were listed as burglary losses, not robbery losses. He looked through the Be on Lookout package for any kind of crime summary, but didn't find any. Just a bureau contact. Special Agent E.D. Wish. Then he noticed in a block on the BOLO sheet that there were 3 dates noted for the date of the crime. A burglary over a 3-day span during the first week of September. Labor Day weekend, he realized. Downtown banks are closed 3 days. It had to have been a safe deposit caper. A tunnel job? Bosch leaned back and thought about that. Why hadn't he remembered it? A heist like that would have played in the media for days. It would have been talked about in the department even longer. Then he realized he had been in Mexico on Labor Day. And for the next 3 weeks. The bank heist had occurred while he was serving the 1-month suspension for the Dollmaker case. He leaned forward, picked up a phone, and dialed.
"Times, Brammer."
"It's Bosch. Still got you working Sundays, huh?"
2 to 10 every Sunday, no parole. So what's up? I haven't talked to you since, your problem with the Dollmaker case. How you liking Hollywood Division?"
"It'll do. For a while, at least." He was speaking low so the duty detective would not overhear. Bremer said,
"Like that, huh? Well, I heard you caught the stiff up at the dam this morning."
Joel Bremer had covered the cop shop for the Times longer than most cops had been on the force, including Bosch. There was not much he didn't hear about the department, or couldn't find out with a phone call. A year ago, he called Bosch for comment on his 22-day suspension, no pay. Bremer had heard about it before Bosch. Generally, the police department hated the Times, and the Times was never short in its criticism of the department. But in the middle of that was Bremer, whom any cop could trust, and many, like Bosch, did.
"Yeah, that's my case," Bosch said.
Right now, it's nothing much, but I need a favor. If it works out the way it's looking, then it'll be something you'd want to know about. Bosch knew he didn't have to bait him, but he wanted the reporter to know there might be something later.
What do you need?
Bremer said. As you know, I was out of town last Labor Day on my extended vacation, courtesy of IAD. So I missed this one, but there was...
The tunnel job. You're not going to ask about the tunnel job, are you? Over here in downtown, all the jewelry, negotiable bonds, stock certificates, maybe drugs?
Bosch heard the reporter's voice go up a notch in urgency. He had been right. It had been a tunnel, and the story had played well. If Bremer was this interested, then it was a substantial case. Still, Bosch was surprised he had not heard of it after coming back to work in October. Yeah, that's the one, he said. I was gone then, so I missed it. Ever any arrests?
Nah, it's open. FBI's doing it, last I checked.
I want to look at the clips on it tonight. Is that all right?
I'll make copies. When are you coming?
I'll head over in a little while.
I take it this has got something to do with this morning stiff?
It's looking that way. Maybe. I can't talk right now. And I know the Phoebes have the case. I'll go see them tomorrow. That's why I want to see the clips tonight.
I'll be here.
After hanging up the phone, Bosch looked down at the FBI photocopy of the bracelet. There was no doubt it was the piece that had been pawned by Meadows and was in Obina's Polaroid. The bracelet in the FBI photo was in place on a woman's liver-spotted wrist. Three small carved fish swimming on a wave of gold. Bosch guessed it was Harriet Beecham's 71-year-old wrist, and the photo had probably been taken for insurance purposes. He looked over at the duty detective, who was still leafing through the gun catalog. He coughed loudly, like he had seen Nicholson do in a movie once, and at the same time tore the bolo sheet out of the binder. The kid detective looked over at Bosch and then went back to the guns and bullets. As he folded the bolo sheet into his pocket, Bosch's electronic pager went off. He picked up the phone and called Hollywood Station, expecting to be told there was another body waiting for him. It was a watch sergeant named Art Crockett, whom everyone called Davy, who took the call.
Harry, you still out in the field?
He said. I'm at Parker Center, had to check on a few things.
Good, then you're already near the morgue. Tech over there, name, Sakai, called. Said he needs to see you.
See me?
He said to tell you that something came up, and they're doing your cut today. Right now, matter of fact.
It took Bosch 5 minutes to get over to County USC Hospital, and 15 minutes to find a parking spot. The medical examiner's office was located behind one of the medical center buildings that had been condemned after the 87 earthquake. It was a two-story, yellow prefab, without much architectural style or life. As Bosch was going through the glass doors where the living people entered and into the front lobby, he passed a sheriff's detective he had spent some time with while working the Night Stalker task force in the early 80s. Hey, Bernie, Bosch said and smiled.
Hey, fuck you, Bosch, Bernie said. The rest of us catch ones at comp, too.
Bosch stopped there a moment to watch the detective walk into the parking lot. Then he went in and to the right, down a government green corridor, passing through two sets of double doors, the smell getting worse each time. It was the smell of death and industrial-strength disinfectant. Death had the upper hand. Bosch stepped into the yellow-tiled scrub room. Larry Sakai was in there, putting a paper gown over his hospital scrubs. He already had on a paper mask and booties. Bosch took a set of the same out of cardboard boxes on a stainless steel counter and started putting them on.
What's with Bernie Slaughter? Bosch asked. What happened in here to piss him off?
You're what happened, Bosch, Sakai said without looking at him. He got a call out yesterday morning. Some 16-year-old shoots his best friend up in Lancaster. Looks like accidental, but Bernie's waiting on us to check the bullet track and powder stippling. He wants to close it. I told him we'd get to it late today, so he came in. Only we aren't going to get to it at all today, because Sally's got a bug up his ass about doing yours. Don't ask me why. He just checked the stiff out when I brought it in and said we'd do it today. I told him we'd have to bump somebody, and he said bump Bernie, but I couldn't get him on the line in time to stop him from coming in, so that's why Bernie's pissed. You know, he lives all the way down to Diamond Bar, long ride in for nothing.
Bosch had the mask, gown, and booties on, and followed Sakai down the tiled hall to the autopsy suite.
Then maybe he ought to be pissed at Sally, not me, he said.
Sakai didn't answer. They walked to the first table where Billy Meadows lay on his back, naked,
his neck braced against a short cut of 2x4 wood. There were 6 of the stainless steel tables in the room. Each had gutters running alongside its edges and drain holes in the corners. There was a body on each. Dr. Jesus Salazar was huddled over Meadows' chest, with his back to Bosch and Sakai.
"Afternoon, Harry, I've been waiting," Salazar said, still not looking. "Larry, I'm going to need slides on this."
The medical examiner straightened up and turned. In his rubber-gloved hand, he held what looked like a square plug of flesh and pink muscle tissue. He placed it in a steel pan, the kind brownies are cooked in, and handed it to Sakai.
"Give me verticals, one of the puncture track, then 2 on either side for comparison."
Sakai took the pan and left the room to go to the lab. Bosch saw that the plug of meat had been cut from Meadows's chest, about 1 inch above the left nipple. "What did you find?" Bosch asked.
"I'm not sure yet. We'll see. The question is, what did you find, Harry? My field tech told me you were demanding an autopsy on this today. Why is that?"
"I told him I needed it today because I wanted to get it done tomorrow. I thought that was what we had agreed on, too."
"Yes, he told me so, but I got curious about it. I love a good mystery, Harry. What made you think this was hinky, as you detectives say?"
"We don't say it anymore," Bosch thought. "Once it's said in the movies and people like Salazar pick it up, it's ancient."
"Just some things didn't fit at the time," Bosch said. "There are more things now. From my end, it looks like a murder. No mystery."
What things?
Bosch got out his notebook and started flipping through the pages as he talked. He listed the things he had noticed wrong at the death scene. The broken finger, the lack of distinct tracks in the pipe, the shirt pulled over the head. "He had a hype kit in his pocket, and we found a stove in the pipe, but it doesn't look right. Looks like a plant to me. Looks like the pop that killed him is in the arm there. Those other scars in his arms are old. He hasn't been using his arms in years."
"You're right about that. Aside from the one recent puncture in the arm, the groin area is the only area where punctures are fresh. The inside thighs, an area usually used by people going to great lengths to hide their addiction. But then again, this could have just been his first time back on the arms. What else you got, Harry?"
"He smoked, I'm pretty sure. There was no pack of cigarettes with the body."
"Couldn't somebody have taken them off the body before it was discovered, a scavenger?"
"True. But why take the smokes and not the kit? There's also his apartment. Somebody searched the place."
"Could have been someone who knew him, someone looking for his stash."
"True again."
Bosch flipped through a few more pages in the notebook.
"The kit on the body had whitish-brown crystals in the cotton. I've seen enough tar heroin to know it turns the straining cotton dark brown, sometimes black. So it looks like it was some fine stuff, probably overseas, that was put in his arm. That doesn't go with the way he was living. That's uptown stuff."
Salazar thought a moment before saying,
"It's all a lot of supposition, Harry."
"The last thing, though, is, and I'm just starting to work on this, he was involved in some kind of caper."
Bosch gave him a brief synopsis of what he knew about the bracelet, its theft from the bank vault and then from the pawn shop. Salazar's domain was the forensic detail of the case, but Bosch had always trusted Sally and found that it sometimes helped to bounce other details of a case off him. The two had met in 1974, when Bosch was a patrolman and Sally was a new assistant coroner. Bosch was assigned guard duty and crowd control on East 54th and South Central, where a firefight with the Symbionese Liberation Army had left a house burned to the ground and 5 bodies in the smoking rubble. Sally was assigned to see if there was a 6th, Patty Hearst, somewhere in the char. The two of them spent 3 days there, and when Sally finally gave up, Bosch had won a bet that she was still alive, somewhere. When Bosch was finished with the story about the bracelet, it seemed to have mollified Sally's worries about the death of Billy Meadows not being a mystery. He seemed energized. He turned to a cart on which his cutting tools were piled and rolled it next to the autopsy table. He switched on a sound-activated tape recorder and picked up a scalpel and a pair of regular gardening shears. He said,
"Well, let's get to work."
Bosch moved back a few steps to avoid any spatter and leaned against a counter on which there was a tray full of knives and saws and scalpels. He noticed that a sign taped to the side of the tray said, "To be sharpened." Salazar looked down at the body of Billy Meadows and began.
The body is that of a well-developed Caucasian male measuring 69 inches in length, weighing 165 pounds, and appearing generally consistent with the stated age of 40 years. The body is cold and unembalmed with full rigor and posterior dependent fixed lividity.
Bosch watched him start, but then noticed the plastic bag containing Meadows's clothes on the counter next to the tool pan. He pulled it over and opened it up. The smell of urine immediately assaulted his nostrils, and he thought for a moment of the living room at Meadows's apartment. He pulled on a pair of rubber gloves as Salazar continued to describe the body.
The left index finger shows a palpable fracture without laceration or petechial contusion or hemorrhage.
Bosch glanced over his shoulder and saw that Salazar was wiggling the broken digit with the blunt end of the scalpel as he spoke to the tape recorder. He concluded his external description of the body by mentioning the skin punctures.
There are hemorrhagic puncture wounds, hypodermic type, on the upper inside thighs and the interior side of the left arm. The arm puncture exudes a bloody fluid and appears to be most recent. No scabbing. There is another puncture in the upper left chest, which exudes a small amount of bloody fluid and appears to be slightly larger than that caused by hypodermic puncture.
Salazar put his hand over the tape recorder speaker and said to Bosch, I'm having Sakai get slides of this chest puncture.
It looks very interesting.
Bosch nodded and turned back to the counter and began spreading out Meadows's clothes. Behind him, he heard Salazar using the shears to open up the dead man's chest. The detective pulled each pocket out and looked at the lint. He turned the socks inside out and checked the inside lining of the pants and shirt. Nothing. He took a scalpel out of the to-be-sharpened pan and cut the stitches out of Meadows's leather belt and pulled it apart. Again, nothing. Over his shoulder, he heard Salazar saying,
The spleen weighs 190 grams. The capsule is intact and slightly wrinkled, and the parenchyma is pale purple and trabecular.
Bosch had heard it all hundreds of times before. Most of what a pathologist said into his tape recorder meant nothing to the detective who stood by. It was the bottom line the detective waited for. What killed the person on the cold steel table? How? Who?
The gallbladder is thin-walled, Salazar was saying. It contains a few cc's of greenish bile with no stones.
Bosch shoved the clothes back into the plastic bag and sealed it. Then he dumped the leather work shoes Meadows had been wearing out of a second plastic bag. He noticed reddish-orange dust fall from inside the shoes, another indication the body had been dragged into the pipe. The heels had scraped on the dried mud at the bottom of the pipe, drawing the dust inside the shoes. Salazar said,
The bladder mucosa is intact, and there are only 2 ounces of pale yellow urine. The external genitalia and vagina are unremarkable.
Bosch turned around. Salazar had his hand on the tape recorder mic. He said,
Coroner's humor. Just wanted to see if you were listening, Harry. You might have to testify to this one day to back me up.
I doubt it, Bosch said. They don't like boring juries to death. Salazar started the small circular saw that was used to open the skull. It sounded like a dentist's drill. Bosch turned back to the shoes. They were well oiled and cared for. The rubber soles showed only modest wear. Stuck in one of the deep grooves of the tread of the right shoe was a white stone. Bosch pried it out with the scalpel. It was a small chunk of cement. He thought of the white dust in the rug in Meadows's closet. He wondered if the dust or the chunk from the shoe tread could be matched to the concrete that had guarded the Westland Bank's vault. But if the shoes were so well cared for, could the chunk have been in the tread for 9 months since the vault break-in? It seemed unlikely. Perhaps it was from his work on the subway project, if he actually had such a job. Bosch slipped the chunk of cement into a small plastic envelope and put it in his pocket with the others he had collected throughout the day. Salazar said,
Examination of the head and cranial contents reveals no trauma or underlying pathological disease conditions or congenital anomalies.
Harry, I'm going to do the finger now.
Bosch put the shoes back in their plastic bag and returned to the autopsy table as Salazar placed an X-ray of Meadows's left hand on a light window on the wall.
See here, these fragments, he said,
as he traced small, sharp, white spots on the negative. There were three of them near the fractured joint. If this was an old break, these would, over time, have moved into the joint. There is no scarring discernible on the X-ray, but I'm going to take a look. He went to the body and used a scalpel to make a T-incision in the skin on the top of the finger joint. He then folded the skin back and dug around with the scalpel in the pink meat, saying,
No, nothing. This was post, Harry. You think it could have been one of my people?
I don't know, Bosch said. Doesn't look like it. Sakai said he and his sidekick were careful. I know I didn't do it. How come there's no damage to the skin?
Now, that is an interesting point. I don't know.
Somehow the finger was broken without the exterior being damaged. I can't answer that one.
But it shouldn't have been too hard to do, just grab the finger and yank down,
provided you have the stomach for it, like so. Salazar went around the table. He lifted Meadows' right hand and yanked the finger backward. He couldn't get the leverage needed and couldn't break the joint.
Well, harder than I thought, he said.
Perhaps the digi was struck with a blunt object of some kind, one that did not blemish the skin. When Sakai came in with the slides 15 minutes later, the autopsy was completed, and Salazar was sewing Meadows' chest closed with thick wax twine. He then used an overhead hose to spray debris off the body and wet down the hair. Sakai bound the legs together and the arms to the body with rope to prevent them from moving during the different stages of rigor. Bosch noticed that the rope cut across the tattoo on Meadows' arm, across the rat's neck. Using his thumb and forefinger, Salazar closed Meadows' eyes.
Take him to the box, he said to Sakai, then to Bosch. Let's take a look at these slides. This seemed odd to me because the hole was bigger than your normal skag spike, and its location in the chest was unusual. The puncture is clearly antemortem, possibly perimortem. There was only slight hemorrhaging, but the wound is not scabbed over, so we're talking shortly before or even during death.
Maybe the cause of death, Harry.
Salazar took the slides to a microscope that was on the counter at the back of the room. He chose one of the slides and put it on the viewing plate. He bent over to look, and after half a minute, finally said,
Interesting.
He then looked briefly at the other slides. When he was done, he put the first slide back on the viewing plate.
Okay. Basically, I removed a 1-inch square section of the chest where this puncture was located. I went into the chest about 1.5 inches deep with the cut. The slide is a vertical dissection of the sample, showing the track of the perforation.
Do you follow me?
Bosch nodded.
Good. It's kind of like slicing an apple open to expose the track of a worm. The slide traces the path of the perforation and any immediate impact or damage.
Take a look.
Bosch bent to the eyepiece of the microscope. The slide showed a straight perforation about 1 inch deep, through the skin and into the muscle, tapering in width like a spike. The muscle's pink color changed to a dark brownish color around the deepest point of the penetration.
What does it mean? He asked.
It means, said Salazar, that the puncture was through the skin, through the fascia, that's the fibrous fat layer, and then directly into the pectoral muscle. You notice the deepening color of the muscle around the penetration?
Yes, I notice.
Harry, that's because the muscle is burned there.
Bosch looked away from the microscope to Salazar. He thought he could make out the line of a thin smile beneath the pathologist's breathing mask.
Burned.
A stun gun, the pathologist said.
Look for one that fires its electrode dart deep into the skin tissue, about 3 to 4 centimeters deep. But in this case, it is likely the electrode was manually pressed deeper into the chest.
Bosch thought a moment. A stun gun would be virtually impossible to trace. Sakai came back into the room and leaned on the counter by the door, watching. Salazar collected 3 glass vials of blood and 2 containing yellowish liquid from the tool cart. There was also a small steel pan containing a brown lump of material that Bosch recognized from experience in this room as liver.
Larry, here are the tox samples, Salazar said.
Sakai took them and disappeared from the room again.
You're talking about torture.
Electric shock, Bosch said.
I would say it looks so, Salazar said. Not enough to kill him. The trauma is too small.
but possibly enough to get information from him. An electric charge can be very persuasive. I think there is ample history on that. With the electrode position in the subject's chest, he could probably feel the juice going right into his heart. He would have been paralyzed. He'd tell them what they wanted and then could only watch while they put a fatal dosage of heroin into his arm.
Can we prove any of this?
Salazar looked down at the tile floor and put his finger on his mask and scratched his lip beneath it.
Bosch was dying for a cigarette. He had been in the autopsy room nearly 2 hours.
Prove any of it, Salazar said. Not medically. Tox tests will be done in a week. For the sake of argument, say they come back heroin overdose. How do we prove that someone else put it in his arm, not himself? Medically? We can't. But we can show that at the time of death, or shortly before, there was a traumatic assault on the body in the form of electric shock. He was being tortured. After death, there is the unexplained damage to the first digit of the left hand. He rubbed the finger over his mask again and then concluded, I could testify that this was a homicide. The totality of the medical evidence indicates death at the hands of others. But, for the moment, there is no cause. We wait for the tox studies to be completed and then we'll put our heads together again. Bosch wrote a paraphrase of what Salazar had just said into his notebook. He would have to type it into his own reports.
Of course, Salazar said. Proving any of this beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury is another matter. I would guess that, Harry, you have to find that bracelet and find out why it was worth torturing and killing a man for.
Bosch closed his notebook and started to pull off the paper gown. The setting sun burned the sky pink and orange in the same bright hues as surfers' bathing suits. It was beautiful deception, Bosch thought, as he drove north on the Hollywood freeway to home. Sunsets did that here. Made you forget it was the smog that made their colors so brilliant, that behind every pretty picture there could be an ugly story. The sun hung like a ball of copper in the driver's side window. He had the car radio tuned to a jazz station, and Coltrane was playing Soul Eyes. On the seat next to him was a file containing the newspaper clippings from Bremer. The file was weighted down by a six-pack of Henry's. Bosch got off at Barham and then took Woodrow Wilson up into the hills above Studio City. His home was a wood-framed, one-bedroom cantilever, not much bigger than a Beverly Hills garage. It hung out over the edge of the hill and was supported by three steel pylons at its midpoint. It was a scary place to be during earthquakes, daring Mother Nature to twang those beams and send the house down the hill like a sled. But the view was the trade-off. From the back porch, Bosch could look northeast across Burbank and Glendale. He could see the purple-hued mountains past Pasadena and Altadena. Sometimes he could see the smoky loom-up and orange blaze of brush fires in the hills. At night, the sound of the freeway below softened, and the searchlights at Universal City swept the sky. Looking out in the valley never failed to give Bosch a sense of power, which he could not explain to himself. But he did know that it was one reason, the main reason, he bought the place and would never want to leave it. Bosch had bought it 8 years earlier, before the real estate boom got seriously endemic, with a down payment of $50,000. That left a mortgage of $1,400 a month, which he could easily afford, because the only things he spent money on were food, booze, and jazz. The down payment money had come from a studio that gave it to him for the rights to use his name in a TV miniseries based on a string of murders of beauty shop owners in Los Angeles. Bosch and his partner during the investigation were portrayed by two mid-level TV actors. His partner took his $50,000 and his pension and moved to Ensenada. Bosch put his down on a house he wasn't sure could survive the next earthquake, but that made him feel as though he were prince of the city. Despite Bosch's resolve never to move, Jerry Edgar, his current partner and part-time real estate man, told him the house was now worth three times what he had paid for it. Whenever the subject of real estate came up, which was often, Edgar counseled Bosch to sell and trade up. Edgar wanted the listing. Bosch just wanted to stay where he was. It was dark by the time he reached the Hill House. He drank the first beer standing on the back porch, looking out at the blanket of lights below. He had a second bottle while sitting in his watch chair, the file closed on his lap. He hadn't eaten all day, and the beer hit him quickly. He felt lethargic and yet jumpy, his body telling him it needed food. He got up and went to the kitchen and made a pressed turkey sandwich that he brought back to the chair with another beer. When he was finished eating, he brushed the sandwich crumbs off the file and opened it up. There had been four Times stories.